Welcome to SCOTUSCast. On January 15, 2008, the Supreme Court decided the Stone Ridge Investment v. Scientific Atlanta case. In a securities law case of paramount importance, the court was asked to consider what, if any circumstances, private investors can sue actors, whether accountants, lawyers, financial advisors, or other businesses, that allegedly participate in a scheme to violate Section 10B of the Securities Exchange Act of 1934. The court ruled that the implied private right of action in Section 10B does not extend to fraud claims against a non-issuer of a security whose allegedly misleading statements and conduct was not directly relied upon by investors in making investment decisions. In this episode of SCOTUSCast, UCLA law professor Stephen Bainbridge offers his own analysis of the case. As always, the Federalist Society itself takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Professor Bainbridge.
I am Stephen Bainbridge, and I am the William D. Warren Professor at the UCLA School of Law. I'm going to discuss the Supreme Court's decision on Tuesday, January 15th, in Stone Ridge Investment Partners versus Scientific Atlanta, in which the court addressed the question of whether the implied private right of action under Section 10B of the Securities Exchange Act of 1934 and Rule 10b-5 thereunder reaches individuals whose acts or statements were not relied upon by investors. Let me begin by offering some background. Stone Ridge has been called the most significant business case to come before the Supreme Court in recent years. The case potentially implicated a wide range of securities regulation issues, although the question on which the Supreme Court took certiorari was rather narrow. The court asked the parties to address the question of whether its prior decision in Central Bank versus First Interstate Bank of Denver foreclosed claims for deceptive conduct under Section 10B and Rule 10b-5, where the defendants in question engaged in transactions with a public corporation with no legitimate business purpose except to inflate artificially the public corporation's financial statements, but where the defendants themselves made no public statements concerning those transactions. Now, Rule 10b-5, of course, is probably the most famous and arguably the most important of all the Securities and Exchange Commission's many rules. The central theme of the rule's history is one of repeated judicial glosses on the relatively innocuous text of the rule. As former Chief Justice William Rehnquist once observed, Rule 10b-5 is a judicial oak, which has grown from little more than a legislative acorn. And in a very real sense, what the court is dealing with here is a species of federal common law, only loosely tied to the statutory text. Now, the anomalous quasi-common law status of Rule 10b-5 came to a head back in 1994 when the Supreme Court decided the Central Bank of Denver case. In Central Bank, the court held that the scope of the conduct that is prohibited by Section 10b, and thus, of course, the rule, is controlled by the text of the statute. Where the plain text of the statute does not resolve some aspect of the Rule 10b-5 causation, courts must infer how the 1934 Congress would have addressed the issue had the 10b-5 cause of action been included as an express provision in the statute. Now, as of course the court has elsewhere acknowledged, this is a very awkward task, but you can count on Justice Scalia to put it more colorfully. He once described this process by saying, quote, "We are imagining here," unquote. The Central Bank did constrain this imaginative process by requiring courts to use the express causes of action in the Securities Acts as the primary model for the Section 10b action. To the extent that Central Bank repudiated the notion that Rule 10b-5 can be thought of as a species of federal common law, the decision posed a significant threat to the further evolution of the rule. In at least some subsequent decisions, however, the interpretive methodology expounded in Central Bank was essentially ignored. And one thus has been left to wonder whether the strict textualist approach taken by the court in the Central Bank case was a one-time aberration. An initial question presented by Stonerich thus was whether the court would rely on the Central Bank methodology. Now, just as Stonerich is situated in the Central Bank line of cases from a methodological perspective, it's also situated in Central Bank from a doctrinal perspective. In Central Bank, the court held there was no implied private right of action against those who aid and abet violations of Rule 10b-5. In effect, liability under Rule 10b-5 is limited to primary rather than secondary actors. Hence, many, including myself, framed the problem presented by Stonerich as one of deciding who qualifies as a primary actor. The factual background of the case is probably well known, but let me give you a brief summary. Plaintiffs were shareholders of a company called Charter Communications, which is one of the nation's largest cable television providers. They alleged that Charter engaged in what plaintiffs called a pervasive and continuous fraudulent scheme intended to artificially boost the company's reported financial results. One of the ways in which the company allegedly did so was by entering into sham transactions with two equipment vendors, Scientific Atlanta and Motorola, and I'll refer to them collectively as the vendors. Allegedly, the deal that Charter entered into with the vendors improperly inflated Charter's reported operating revenues and cash flow. At the time in question, Charter delivered cable services through set-top boxes. Charter purchased the set-top boxes from third parties, including the vendors. In August 2000, although Charter had firm contracts with the vendors to purchase set-top boxes at a specified price, Charter offered to pay the vendors an additional $20 per set-top box, in exchange for which the vendors would return those additional payments to Charter in the form of advertising fees. Plaintiffs allege that these were sham transactions with no economic substance, but that they had been contrived to inflate Charter's operating cash flow by some $17 million in the fourth quarter of 2000 in order to meet revenue and cash flow expectations of Wall Street analysts. Charter accomplished this by improperly capitalizing the increased equipment expenses while treating the returned advertising fees as immediate revenue. Plaintiffs allege that the vendors entered into these sham transactions knowing that Charter intended to account for them improperly, and that analysts would rely on the inflated revenues and operating cash flow in making stock recommendations. Plaintiffs did not allege that the vendors played any role in preparing or disseminating the fraudulent financial statements and the fraudulent press releases through which Charter published its deception to analysts and investors. One way of looking at the issue was to ask whether Central Bank left any room for secondary liability, and if so, whether the vendors are secondary actors whose conduct falls into a viable category of secondary liability. Alternatively, one could ask whether the vendor's conduct constitutes a primary violation, which would not run afoul of Central Bank. Yet another alternative was to seize upon the phrase, quote, scheme to defraud, unquote, in the text of Rule 10b-5, to argue that that invokes the so-called scheme liability theory. The Supreme Court took cert in Stonerich to resolve the circuit split on whether scheme liability claims differ substantively from the Central Bank barred claims for aiding and abetting against these same actors. Although the Eighth and Fifth Circuits had ruled that scheme liability cannot be squared with Central Bank's prohibition on aiding and abetting liability, the Ninth Circuit had ruled that it can do so under limited circumstances. In deciding the Stonerich case, the Supreme Court surprised many observers by approaching the problem from an unexpected direction. The court began by noting that Central Bank had abolished the court began by noting that Central Bank prohibited imposition of aiding and abetting liability upon secondary actors. Instead of going on to determine whether the vendors were primary or secondary actors, however, the court indicated that all secondary actors can be held liable if the elements and preconditions for Rule 10b-5 liability can be satisfied as against them. Specifically, the court stated that, quote, the Section 10b implied private right of action does not extend to aiders and abettors. But the court then went on to state, quote, the conduct of a secondary actor must satisfy each of the elements or preconditions for liability, unquote. It is thus possible that Stoneridge opens the door to a more expansive concept of secondary liability than had appeared to be the case prior to the decision. In any case, the court went on to ask whether the elements of a Rule 10b-5 cause of action could be made out against the vendors, in concluding that the vendors had no Rule 10b-5 liability. The court focused on the issue of reliance. The court noted that the vendors had no duty to disclose to the shareholders of Charter, and that their allegedly deceptive acts were never communicated to the investing public. No member of the investing public knew anything about the alleged deception during the relevant time period. And thus, by definition, the plaintiffs would be unable to show any form of reliance. Hence, the vendors had no liability. The court also used the reliance element of Rule 10b-5 as justification for rejecting scheme liability in this context. The plaintiffs argued that the defendant vendors had engaged in conduct with the intent and the effect of creating a false appearance of material facts that would further a scheme to misrepresent Charter's revenue. The plaintiffs argued that the financial statements that Charter released were a natural and expected consequence of the deceptive acts committed by the vendors. According to the court majority, the plaintiffs thus contended that in an efficient market, investors rely not only upon public statements relating to the security made by the issuer, but also on the underlying transactions those statements reflect. The court rejected this argument on several grounds. First, the court noted that following Central Bank, Congress had passed the Private Securities Litigation Reform Act, the PSLRA, of 1995, one of whose provisions vested the SEC with authority to prosecute those who aid and abet Rule 10b-5 violations. According to the court, to adopt the plaintiff's argument would revive in substance the implied cause of action under Rule 10b-5 as against all aiders and abettors except those who committed no deceptive acts in the process of facilitating the fraud, and that this would undermine Congress's intent that this class of defendants should be pursued solely by the SEC and not by private litigants. Secondly, the court also focused on the practicalities of the implications of the plaintiff's argument. The majority expressed concern that the plaintiff's argument would reach the whole marketplace in which the issuing company does business, and thus expand the federal securities laws beyond the securities market to the realm of financing business, the purchase and supply contracts, and the realm of ordinary business operations. Such an expansion, the majority argued, would improperly thrust the federal securities laws into areas already governed by functioning and effective state laws, and would unnecessarily impinge upon already sufficient criminal penalties and enforcement by the SEC. In addition, the court argued that plaintiff's theories would expose a new class of defendants to the risk of private securities litigation, creating the potential that plaintiffs with weak claims might be able to extort settlements from innocent companies. Perhaps the most curious part of the court's analysis, however, was its explicit reference to the impact that an opinion upholding the plaintiff's theory might have on the competitiveness of U.S. capital markets. Justice Anthony Kennedy wrote for the majority that, quote, overseas firms with no exposure to our securities laws could be deterred from doing business here. This, in turn, may raise the cost of being a publicly traded company under our law and shift securities offerings away from domestic capital markets. The dissent and many observers have commented that this sort of explicit policy-driven decision-making is something better left for Congress than the courts. Yet, in dealing with the implied private rights of action, we're dealing with an area of the law that has been premised on public policy considerations from the very beginning. In the 1960s, when the court began creating the implied private rights of action under the federal securities laws, there was an express policy goal summarized in the so-called Private Attorneys General Project of ensuring what was perceived by the courts to be an adequate level of deterrence of securities violations by inviting private litigation. Now the court is invoking public policy considerations that point in the opposite direction, namely in the direction of cutting back on private securities litigation. Perhaps two wrongs do not make a right, but it's worth remembering that in the area of implied private rights of action, we are really dealing with a species of federal common law, and it should not be surprising that the law in this area would develop as the common law historically has done through an ebb and flow of judicial decisions. Many commentators will applaud the outcome in Stone Ridge precisely because it addresses the impact that litigation has on the competitiveness of U.S. capital markets. Over the last year or so, we have seen three major reports: the Paulson Committee, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, and the McKinsey study done for Mayor Bloomberg and Senator Schumer, all of which have identified the risk of securities litigation as a major deterrent to foreign companies seeking to raise capital in the U.S. capital markets. By reducing the liability exposure that foreign companies face for doing business in the United States, Stone Ridge addresses that problem. Yet, while Stone Ridge's outcome may be praiseworthy, the means by which the court got there are quite problematic. The case had been teed up as one involving the parameters of secondary liability. By shifting the analysis to the question of reliance, some will argue that the court's majority itself committed deceptive conduct. The argument made by the dissent is first that the court has long indicated that conduct as well as statements can be fraudulent. The most obvious example of this would be forms of manipulation, such as wash sales or cross sales, which have long been understood to violate Rule 10b-5. Second, The Supreme Court in Basic versus Levinson had held that the fraud on the market theory provides adequate support for a presumption that investors in publicly traded companies rely on publicly made material misstatements that affect the price of the company's stock. Hence, investors need not be aware of the specific deceptive act which violates Section 10B. Taken together, the dissent argued, the plaintiffs should have been deemed to satisfy the reliance requirement by alleging that the vendors knew their deceptive acts would be the basis for statements by Charter that would affect the market price of Charter stock, and that their acts had the foreseeable effect of causing the plaintiff to engage in securities transactions. This line of argument makes a good deal of sense. Accordingly, while I believe the Supreme Court reached the right result in this case, it did so for the wrong reasons. Hence, I find myself relying on the old cliche that only time will tell what mischief may result from the way in which the Stone Ridge case was decided.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. For more episodes of SCOTUSCast, as well as audio and video from past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.